This spring, I found myself in New York City, and I hadn't been there for about a dozen years or so.
I was visiting my sister, who's in Jersey City. You get from Jersey City to Manhattan, you take the PATH train, which travels underneath the water and takes you to Manhattan. And ordinarily, when you get off the train, you're underground, but this time when we got there, it's different. You find yourself in open air, even though you can't really see the outside, and you realize that you are in the pit. You are in ground zero. You are in what was the footprint of the Twin Towers, and of course they are there no longer. And you look around, and it's really striking because you see these images that you've seen on TV or in movies where it happened, photographs 100 times. You see the slurry wall, which kept the foundation of the towers dry, as I understand it. And you see cranes, you see a hub of activity, a lot of men and machines moving a lot of material. And as you do that, you see what's in front of you, but at the same time, your mind can't help but recall what happened 6 years ago, which I'm sure all of you recall as clearly as I do. And those images sort of juxtapose in your head. So when we got off the train, I asked my sister, we could just walk around the station a little bit, and I wanted to see the site. And everything that I needed to see was there. I mean, I could see with my own eyes. I knew the history of the site. I knew what was happening at the site at the time. And yet I found myself looking for some type of poster or plaque or kiosk or something, some kind of explanatory device, because I needed more, I felt like, to really understand it. And I don't know about all of you, but if I go to a museum and I see a painting that I'm really struck by, one of the first things I do is I look at the plaque next to the painting and I see who painted it and when they painted it and what the response was. Now, my own eyes, my own mind should be able to give me everything I need to understand what I'm looking at, and yet I find that I want something a little bit more. Now, what this means for today is that I think that there's a bit of a gap in our minds between what we perceive and how we perceive, what we decide that thing means. And I'm going to argue today that the meaning of what we perceive is self-evident, that in fact, there is a gap between our perceptions and our responses. And it's that area that I want to talk about today, because I'm going to argue to you that that area is controlled by narrative, by storytelling, telling ourselves stories, the things we see that are resonant to us and correspond with our life experiences in some way feel true. Now, that matters to us because if you're a trial attorney and you can control those responses,
it could potentially affect the outcome of a trial, which leads me to today's talk, which is entitled Framing the Debate, Using the Power of Narrative to Craft Winning Trial Strategies. And before I begin, first, I'm a bit under the weather, hence the smoothie. So bear with me on that, and hopefully my voice doesn't give out. Second, I'm a defense attorney in Seattle. I've delivered this before to defense attorneys, never to a general, I guess not general interest audience because you're law students, but never to a general audience. So keep that in mind as you hear this. I've never given it to prosecutors because I don't have any desire to make better prosecutors. Unless somebody steals something from me, in which case I want the very best prosecutor on that, but y'all have to promise not to be prosecutors in Seattle once you've heard this. And finally, I want to thank first Dean Emery, who's been a great help to me over the past 8 years as I've tilted at various windmills in the world of public interest law. Second to Andrew Broaddus for logistical support for today. There's a saying in the military that amateurs talk strategy, professionals talk logistics, and that is without question true. And finally, to Jared Gattaccio, who really helped make this happen, and he's a man who I believe walks it like he talks it, not to make more work for him, but you owe it yourself to sit down and talk to him at some point as you make your career decisions. Framing the debate. People think in stories. The mind has a difficult time processing facts that aren't embedded in a narrative. The reason for this is the meaning of facts is not self-evident. Facts on their own don't mean anything. So what gives facts meaning? Story is what gives facts meaning, not the other way around. And I'm aware this all sounds terribly theoretical, and so to keep ourselves grounded in the courtroom, which is what this is about, I want to start with some functional definitions. So the first chapter of today's story is, what's a story? A story is an organizing structure for facts, which imbues those facts with meaning. The three key terms, organizing structure, facts, and meaning. So the first ingredient, structure. Your story needs a cohesive structure. This does two things. It makes the facts easier to understand, and it's good to advance your strategic goals. Now, structure may depend, it may change depending on what your goals are, the strengths and weaknesses of your case, and primacy and recency, blah, blah, blah. But this will all play out in your closing, which is the only time you get to tell your story from start to finish. It's this organizing principle that separates a story from just a bunch of facts. Second ingredient is facts. Facts can be fixed or they can be disputed. A fixed fact is you have a victim with a bloody nose. A disputed fact is the victim was punched in the nose by the defendant, or, more pressingly sometimes, that the defendant intended to punch the victim in the nose. So you find all facts, fixed or disputed, are things you need to account for. We'll return to this. The final ingredient is meaning. As I said earlier, story isn't just a bunch of well-organized facts. An encyclopedia is a bunch of well-organized facts. What separates an encyclopedia from a story is the fact that the story is resonant. It means something to us. It's consistent with life experience. It feels true to us, but at the same time, it illuminates something that's foreign to us. It tells us a story we wouldn't otherwise know. This last ingredient, meaning, without which a story is just a bunch of stuff that happened, is perhaps the most important. It's why the listener should care. Without it, you got nothing. So again, what does all this have to do with us as attorneys? Good question. Chapter 2. How do jurors think? Now, if you're facing some bad evidence and you want to, as a defense attorney, you want to craft a strategy that's going to lead to an acquittal, start with the following supposition. Jurors don't know anything. It's kind of an old saw, kind of a joke among attorneys, but it's not always a bad thing. Jurors aren't lawyers. They don't know anything. So you got to ask yourself, and this is your starting question, what do jurors want to hear? What do they want to know? I think that we think jurors want vengeance. They want to punish people. They want to make people pay for what they think they did. But I'm going to argue that more than that, jurors want explanations. They want to hear every fact accounted for. They want to hear an explanation for the facts they didn't hear. And they want to know how to organize all these facts that they hear. And they want to know the criteria to help them separate the important facts from the irrelevant facts. They want to know which facts are real and credible, which are just self-interested claims they shouldn't believe. Jurors really want this. One thing you will be appalled to find when you start practicing is how poor jurors look. They just sit down and they're about to fall asleep. But the truth is, jurors want to do their job well. Jurors are hungry. They don't want to look stupid in front of the other jurors. And who's going to help them with this? It's going to be the judge who's reading the jury instructions in a bored monotone because she's done 8,000 times. It's going to be the prosecutor with their big white poster board and her Sharpie listing the elements. They all do that. Or it's going to be a defense attorney who's clinging to a life raft of reasonable doubt, using all our energy to rebut the city's case? Is any of those approaches going to help a juror sift through all that evidence? As a defense attorney, I try to take my jurors by the hand and lead them gently and respectfully along, fact by fact. The only thing I'll tell them to do is be thorough, be conscientious. I don't tell them to quit. Prosecutors tell jurors what to do. And any of us, if you tell us what to think, we're going to be offended. We're probably going to do the opposite. I know I'm like that. Probably any parent knows that. So what you need to do is something more powerful. You need to create a space for a juror within which to think doing anything but acquitting if you're a defense attorney. Be crazy. Before law school, I worked at a bike shop in Beverly Hills. It was owned by a guy named Steve Liebenstein, who was one of the best salespeople I'd ever met. And I talked to him once after watching him operate for a few months, and I said, how do you do it? And he said, the trick to sales is to make somebody feel like a bonehead for buying a bicycle somewhere else. So how do you construct a narrative that's going to make a juror feel like a bonehead for convicting a guy? Well, I think the best way to begin is to think about what jurors need. They need explanations for facts and omissions. They need the criteria to decide which facts are relevant. And they need to know how to determine the credibility of all the witnesses they hear. So as you start to shape the building blocks of your case, ask yourself, how can I shape my case in a way that's going to help jurors resolve these issues of weight and credibility? So if you're a prosecutor, you can talk and talk about how bad and how guilty the defendant is, but you need to show them what's more convincing. You need to show them a process, a path, that can only lead to guilt. So chapter 3, objectives and ingredients and narratives. So we talked about the what of a narrative. I want to talk about the how now, about the mechanics. So how can we as trial attorneys construct a story which is going to shape the jurors' deliberations? Every trial attorney, your main goal is, when they're back there in that room, you want them to hear your voice in their head as they sit through all that evidence. Not the other side's voice, not the judge's voice, but your voice. So if you want to do that, you've got to construct a narrative that does four things. And this is very mechanical and it's a little bit boring, but this is important because every piece of evidence you go through fits in one of these categories. Your narrative has to do four things. It has to be consistent with the fixed facts. It's got to explain those facts in a manner compatible with your theory of the case, because as I said earlier, facts can mean a lot of different things. You need to tell the jury what those facts mean. The third thing, it's got to reinforce disputed facts that are consistent with your theory of the case. And the fourth and final thing your story has to do, it's got to cast doubt on disputed facts that aren't compatible with your theory of the case. Those are the four things your story's got to do. And every piece of information that you go through when you're determining how you're going to package and sell your trial to a jury goes through that process, goes through that machine. And it sounds very methodical right now, but you get to a point where you can do it automatically. So every piece of data passes through that. I want to talk a little bit about the ingredients. First, you've got the fixed facts. If you can't exclude a fixed fact by a pretrial motion, then you need explanations, you need motivations for those. And you can't leave any fixed fact unaddressed. You can say whether or not you think it's important, but you can't leave them out. When you don't talk about something, that is a huge red flag for jurors in their deliberations. I was explaining to a gentleman here earlier, I always talk to juries after trials. And most trial attorneys are really snotty about that. I'm above talking to jurors. That's idiotic. I always talk to jurors. I don't know how many times a jury has reached a deliberation, or has reached a verdict on some fact that neither me nor the prosecutor thought even had. And I got caught by that enough times that I'm not too proud to talk to jurors now. So you need to account for every fact. And if you try to leave out some fact because it's bad for you, credibility goes out the window. You also need to consider motivations, because facts don't mean anything unless people know why the actor brought those facts into being. You know, what's the intent behind that? And of course, in the law, the intent matters quite a bit. And the final thing to think about is characters. We talked some Tuesday about stereotyping. Your client's going to be stereotyped. The victim's going to be stereotyped. All the witnesses are going to be stereotyped. So you have to be aware of the issue of character, how the people are going to come across. Generally, characters you'll find in any movie or in any novel are defined by their interests. How do they want that story to go? That's generally what determines their credibility, which is why people, for example, find cops more credible than they find defendants. Characters are also defined by their correspondence to types we already know, a.k.a. stereotypes, the nosy neighbor, the jealous partner, the faithful friend, the rookie cop, the jaded cop, the racist cop, the thorough cop, what have you. Basically, a type is what makes a juror think, I know that guy. And you might want to exploit this in a way, you might want to exploit the way that jurors think they know these types, or might want to invert it if your client, if your defense attorney appears to be somebody that your average, you know, school teacher, retired engineer, juror wouldn't want to go out for a beer with after the trial. Malcolm Gladwell, the New Yorker writer, wrote a piece on vicious dogs in the New Yorker a few years back. And I want you to visualize for a moment a pit bull and what leaps to mind when you hear those two words, pit bull. Now, here's what Gladwell wrote. The writer Vicky Hearn told me, there are a lot of pit bulls these days who are licensed therapy dogs. Their stability and resoluteness makes them excellent for work with people who might not like a more bouncy or flighty sort of dog. When pit bulls set out to provide comfort, they're as resolute as they are when they fight. But what they're resolute about is being gentle. And because they're fearless, they can be gentle with anybody. I just think that's an amazing passage. Because here, Gladwell takes our preconceived notion of what a pit bull is like and basically turns it on its head. He doesn't disagree with us, but he says, the thing that you think makes him so bad makes him so good for this particular thing. If you've got a frightening client, you've got to take that into account. You've got to find a way oftentimes to turn the juror's expectations on their head and make them see your client for what he or she is. In Henry James' novel, one of the characters says, an envelope of circumstances encloses every human life. I love that. An envelope of circumstances encloses every human life. If you're a defense attorney, can you, without being a relativist, illuminate the corners of your client's envelope for your jury? So, of course, we can't talk about types without talking about stereotypes. Stereotypes are always the underpinning gorilla in the room. I had a child abuse case, I think I mentioned this Tuesday. I had a client, black guy, late 30s, big guy, played ball when he was younger. And he had spanked his son, who was about 7 years old, the cutest kid in the world. Just a cute little kid. And the law in Washington State says that you can use reasonable force to discipline a child. He had spanked his son, and he had left a handprint on his son's behind that was so bad. One of the EMT's response, that was the worst thing he'd ever seen. So, obviously I had my work cut out for me, and the prosecutor tried to make my client, I don't know if you've ever seen the film The Great Santini, it's basically about this sort of really mean, jerky, aggressive dad who's always abusing his son. Tried to make him sound like that guy. My client, in fact, was the opposite of that. And he had been a foster parent. So, they do a background to be a foster parent. And I'm sorry, background check. I'd asked him about that, because I wanted juries to know he was a foster parent. Ideally, he was a foster parent. So they do a background check for that, right? Yeah. And he answered, we talked about that, and he answered the question the way that I didn't want him to. He said, and they said I had nothing in my background.
The big issue in this trial is 404-609 stuff, because the fact that you had a criminal record is fairly serious felonies. But there are a lot of times that you need to know. So the prosecutor tries to get that in, out goes the jury, we fight over it. The judge ends up playing this criminal history. So the prosecutor gets to go through each one of these felony conventions, all these cases, and all of a sudden everything she's called upon is here. So she does this, and I'm just sitting there, and then I talk to her, and I say, now these convictions, these, when was the last?
Why these happen?
And I do this. She said, well, I did an alcohol the program, got cleaned up. I said, you're being worse than that. And I said, really, there's trouble since then. And all of a sudden, the juror's stereotype of this guy is a thug. It's turned on its head. He's still the same guy, but now they're thinking, this guy's Mr. Bootstraps, you know? And the prosecutor ended up looking at him fully. She's kicking him around about all this stuff that he's fixed. And the jurors thought what I wanted to think, which is, he's spanked his son because his son didn't want to go to the house. And Dad said, you don't have to play, he's just got to suit up, he's got to report. He got to go. And then whether or not he plays, I'm the coach. And the jurors are thinking, because I had an all-white jury, Seattle's a very, very white town, and the jurors are thinking, this guy's a great dad. He just wants his son to go to practice. And that was really responsible. They really responded to that. I talked to them afterwards about this. Now, you've got to remember, stereotypes are very much a double-edged sword. And if the use of a stereotype can get your client acquitted, use it. Use it. So, we've talked about character. I want to talk a little bit about themes. So, what's a theme? It's pretty simple. A theme is what a story's about. And your theory of the case is the theme of the story. So ask yourself, what's a compelling story generally about? Redemption, loyalty, loss, suffering, triumph, betrayal. And you got to ask yourself, is my story inspirational? Is it tragic? Is it cautionary? These themes will give a story its universality. So it makes any story, even, I don't know about you, but you can turn on a soap opera for like 15 seconds, and I don't watch TV, I don't even have one, but you turn that on for 15 seconds and I'm hooked. I want to know how that story ends. You need to craft a story like that. So the theme is what makes a jury care. Now, my introduction about 9/11, you'll notice I didn't say my revelation for this talk came from like Gilligan's Island or something like that. You need to find important issues that are going to resonate with jurors. And that might sound manipulative to you, and I don't think that is manipulative, since we live in a nation of laws and not of men, although it may not seem that way these days. You need to make your trial about something more than the immediate facts of the case. Needs to be about something big. It needs to matter. And that will empower the jurors to do what you think they need to do. And the trouble with themes is prosecutors are often one-note players, so the defendant's bad, he needs to go to jail, and strike a very self-righteous, I think, judgmental tone. And that doesn't encourage the kind of empathy jurors need. Or worse, the prosecutor just lays out the elements on their little whiteboard and they sit down. Is that what jurors need? What jurors need is guidance. Brings us to chapter 4. Give them the jury what they need. Now, I had two trials a while ago with very different outcomes. A patronizing trial, patronizing prostitute, versus an assault trial. The patronizing trial had genuine language issues. It was an undercover cop playing a prostitute. My client was Korean, spoke no English, and I thought, how can they convict this guy? Then I had an assault trial with some horrible pictures, victim had a bloody nose. And both ended up with the opposite result of what I expected. In the assault case, I talked to the jury, and I heard the very best words the defense attorney can hear from the jury, which is, and again, this is the case where they have pictures of a victim with a bloody nose. There's no question that bloody nose is possible. And the jury says, we felt bad for the prosecutor. We felt like they had a really bad case. They had nothing there. Sort of felt bad for they're trying to make the most of the other evidence. Great, you know. And then the patronizing trial, I heard the very worst words you can hear as a defense attorney from a jury, which is, well, we weren't sure if he was guilty or not. We weren't really sure if the city met their burden, if we were really convinced beyond a reasonable doubt. So we decided to convict him. And that's about the worst thing you can hear. And for those of us who live in a world of legal abstractions, we kind of forget that reasonable doubt or burden of proof is about as abstract to most jurors as E equals MC squared is to us. Now, E equals MC squared, I've heard of that, and I know that in some way that matters, but I have no idea what it's for. I would have no idea how to use that. Just a phrase to me. So I think if we as attorneys want to impart on our jurors the importance of these concepts, we just spend some time trying to think like jurors do. And I think being comfortable with the narrative that you present to your jurors means basically couching the narrative in the terms of these important legal law concepts.
And it also means making your narrative about something beyond immediate facts. One thing you find yourself doing a lot if you do misdemeanor practice is the defense attorneys do what the cops didn't do cases. Everybody watches that CSI show these days. I guess it's the most popular show in the country or something. Your average misdemeanor in Seattle, the cops come in, they do about 10 seconds of cursory investigation. They write one paragraph of police report. And oftentimes you have a client who definitely without question stole that candy bar from the drugstore. But you need more of what than that. So you turn those into what I call what the cop didn't do cases. You go through this whole dog and pony show with the cop. You take fingerprints. No. Did you take DNA? No. I mean, was there any film of this or any videos? You go through this whole litany of things the cops didn't do. If you do this properly, then the city's burden of proof becomes part of your story. If there was, for example, potentially a witness who could have potentially given testimony to be good for your client, the cops didn't even bother to get this guy's name, that's a point you need to make to a jury. So the absence of evidence can be as powerful a part of your narrative as evidence can. And I think this works best as a defense attorney if you have a jury that feels empowered to make decisions independently, doesn't just rubber stamp the city's case. For me, I think the more that you as a defense attorney can explain to a jury, this case is yours, not the prosecutor's, and the buck stops with you, the more likely they are to see the prosecutor's kind of a used car salesman and realize the importance of their role. If you can make a juror, as they're sitting in the jury box, think, you know, I'm not just a juror, I'm Ben Franklin. I'm Thomas Paine, you know, score one for democracy. Then they're more likely to see things your way, I believe. So, well, I remember the first trial I had done at ACA when I first got there. I had to fill in for another attorney, so I didn't have a lot of time to prep it. My client, a homeless guy, was accused of assaulting an old man who had pulled into the parking space where my client was sitting. And the city didn't produce the victim. They didn't produce any police officers. They had exactly one witness. The trouble was, it was the ideal witness. It was a neutral third-party witness, and they're always the best ones. We saw it all happen from across the street. She saw the whole thing, and she had no motive to make anything up at all. And so they convicted. And I talked to the jury afterwards, and the jury said to me, we were mad at the city. We were angry at the fact that they only produced one witness. Where was the cop? Where was the victim? We felt shortchanged. Not shortchanged enough to acquit my client, but they convicted. The mistake that I made there, and the thing that I didn't see, is that I should have used their anger against the city, putting on such a light case, even though their case was ironclad. I could have used that against the city, and I failed to do that. So, if you want to create that compelling narrative, if you want to package that information in a way that you can be the city's guided evidence, how do you do that? Chapter 4. Give the jurors what they need. The trouble with trial practice, and you'll find those of you who have done court or the first year thing you do where you argue, I think, some sort of appellate issue, is that you live in the evidence so deeply that you forget what it looks like. I think you sort of lose the forest from the trees. And jurors don't know the facts nearly as well. They're hearing them for the first time. So if you want to give the jurors what they need, you need to organize the evidence. When you present it to them, it could be by witness in your closing, chronologically, by degrees of credibility, whatever suits your theme best. You also need to prioritize the evidence. You know, what's the wheat and what's the chaff? What's solid and what's spurious? You got to use the evidence to tell a story so the jury can make their decisions about what the evidence means, because as I said in the beginning, the meaning of facts is never self-evident. Now, the story needs to be credible as well as compelling. It's got to have internal consistency. If every witness says that the incident happened at 8, except your client who says it happened at 6, and the time of the incident is probative, then your story won't work no matter how much your tearjerker it is. Your story's got to be all-inclusive. You've got to account for all the evidence the jury's going to hear. You can't run from bad evidence. You cannot. One of the great koans of trial practice, in fact. Koan is the Buddhist thing, like the sound of one hand clapping. Embrace your worst evidence. And that's true. Because if you appear afraid of it, if you squirm, jurors are going to notice that. And finally, there's the sniff test. We all know what that is. I mean, all for creativity, but you've got to recognize its limits. So before we move to our final chapter, I want to say a little bit about the terrain of the courtroom. Now, you're going to lay the groundwork for the theory of your case with your pretrial motions. I'll go through police report with a highlighter. I'll highlight every single thing I don't like, and I'll try to find a credible legal rationale for getting that away from a jury. We all know the landscape of what a jury can and can't hear is completely artificial. Completely artificial. It's got nothing to do with truth and everything to do with the rules of evidence. But the jury doesn't know that. And like the musician who practices 10 hours a day to give a totally naturalistic performance, you have to lay the groundwork with your pretrial motions so that when the jury just sees a cohesive finished product, they don't know all the legal work that went into it. You don't want them to know. So the final chapter, our fifth and final chapter, is technique. And again, I apologize for rushing. This is ordinarily a longer presentation, but I do want to try to get through everything today. It's important that you don't forget that you're a public speaker. As a consequence, you have an obligation to be interested. Now, this may or may not be different at an appellate level. I have no idea. But that's a different talk. But in front of a jury, if you think the righteousness of your argument or the self-evident guilt or innocence of the defendant subtracts from the need for you to be a captivating speaker, you are doing a huge disservice to your case. It's imperative you give a juror every single reason to go your way. So you need to figure out what method of delivery is going to work best for each of you. And you need to be aware of how you come across to a jury. Most of the good lawyers you've ever encountered have a persona. And I will bet you they've given more than a minute's thought to the way that they're perceived, the way they come across. If you're Miles Davis, you can, you know, stand up there with your back to the audience. If you're that brilliant, maybe you could do that. But I don't think Clarence Darrow was reading his closings in a sort of bored nasal monotone without looking up. Now, what, of course, distinguishes the best salesmen from the okay ones is the best salesmen don't look like they're selling. They're standing up there, and they give off this vibe, like, I don't need to sell. What I've got here, this just sells itself. So you need to get up there. You need to be impassioned, but by all means, you need to show the jury how much you care. You don't want to be needy. Jurors recognize that as well. You've got to deliver your case with a degree of conviction. I don't have to sell you on this case, because only a bonehead will go the opposite way of the way I think this should go. If you do that, the jury is going to be back there deliberating. They're going to think, well, that prosecutor had some pretty bad pictures, but the defense attorney kept waving those bad pictures around. He didn't seem afraid of them at all. Now, you've got to be careful not to appear, you know, insane. But give some thought to your presentation. Don't just use legal arguments. Give some attention to your instincts. If you're a defense attorney, ask yourself, why do you feel like your defendant shouldn't be convicted? Why do you feel like he's innocent? Why do you feel like the CS case is a bunch of crap? Can you find a way to compose and deliver a closing that you really believe in, intellectually and emotionally? A lot of the salesmanship, of course, is rooted in some fairly obvious mechanics. No matter how slow you think you're talking very fast. Two, as my grandmother always told me, enunciate. You gotta make sure everybody can hear you. Three, make eye contact. Don't be afraid of your jurors. Craig Platt, the guy I first worked for when I got out of law school, his theory for closings was, he said, you keep delivering closing every juror. Get there and stop. You're basically like full of juries until they all agree with them. So don't be afraid of your jurors. Engage your jurors. Again, give them every reason to like you. Fourth, don't forget to pause for emphasis, especially on your big points. You get a big hit, let it sink in. And watch your jurors and see if it is sinking. If it's not, figure out another way to stay. Fifth, modulate your tone and your volume. And finally, be aware of your own tics. If you're an ummer or an other, or you say like a lot, fix it. Remember, courtroom talk is not the same as the talk you do with your friends. Be aware of that. The very best thing you can do for yourself is actually have somebody record you sometimes. They do that in the trial ad class, and you watch yourself, and it's appalling. It's like that feeling of when you hear your voice in the answering machine times 10. Imagine yourself being photographed naked in a very, very brightly lit room. I mean, you don't want to see that. You want to do all those sort of illusions, but figure out what you're doing right and what you're doing wrong. Seven, use persuasive language. You'll notice I didn't name the CLE How to Lose Less with a bunch of made-up shit. Language is your friend. I considered that, but ultimately, no. Consistency in language enhances your persuasiveness. Stay on message, as they say. Because if you can control the language, you can control the substance. That's what framing the debate is really all about. You know who's really good at this? Republicans. Death tax. Troop surge. Cut and run. Stuff is brilliant. Stuff's amazing. Because if you can decide what the debate's about, you're probably going to win the debate. Like I lost it on that assault case with no victim and no cop. I should have made it about sloppy police work. I should have made it about my client's constitutional rights and might have won, because then I decide what it's about. So consider that. You think Jews call the Torah the Old Testament like the Christians do? You think Christians call Muhammad the seal of the prophets as Muslims do? Language matters a lot. Another thing you can do to be persuasive, use literary devices, simile, metaphor, analogy. These are all basically very condensed storytelling, where you say to a jury, to that thing you don't know, which is the innocence or guilt of the client, This, like this other thing, this thing you do know, and this can be a very powerful tool, not to be underestimated. I read an article in the Times a while ago by a linguist, a linguistics professor at UC Berkeley, a guy named George Lakoff, and he wrote, "Metaphors are more than language. They can govern thought and behavior. A recent University of Toronto study, for example, demonstrated the power of metaphors that connect morality and purity. People who washed their hands after contemplating an unethical act were less troubled by their thoughts than those who didn't," the researchers found. Astonishing. So remember, the meaning of facts is never self-evident. People think about things in terms of other things. Can you find a governing metaphor for your case? The right metaphor can help a jury see what you want them to see in a way that no amount of testimony can. And finally, if you're a trial attorney, you want to learn to revel in beautiful language. Read. That's one of the best things you can do. Read as much as you can. The novelist Robert Stone wrote, "Description allows deeper penetration. Attaches itself to the rods and cones of our interior perception. Language is the process that lashes experience to the intellect." When you describe, you want a jury to see, and your language at its best can express moral authority. I'm almost done here. I want to just read quickly. I don't know if any of you have heard of the Bixby letter. It's a letter that may have been written by Abraham Lincoln, or possibly by a secretary, it's not known, to a woman named Miss Bixby, who lost five sons, it was thought, in the Civil War. And he wrote this to her, very brief. "Dear Madam, I've been shown in the files of the War Department a statement of the Adjutant General of Massachusetts that you are the mother of five sons who have died gloriously on the field of battle. I feel how weak and fruitless must be any word of mine which should attempt to beguile you from the grief of a loss so overwhelming. But I cannot refrain from tendering you the consolation that may be found in the thanks of the Republic that they died to save. I pray that our Heavenly Father may assuage the anguish of your bereavement and leave you only the cherished memory of the loved and lost, and the solemn pride that must be yours to have laid so costly a sacrifice upon the altar for you. Yours, very sincerely and respectfully, A. Lincoln." Now, no matter how you feel about his politics, even the most ardent supporter of George Bush would have to agree he's not our nation's best orator. Imagine had he gone to Cindy Sheehan the first day she parked herself outside of his ranch, said those words to her, and meant them. Imagine how that would have changed her. I can't imagine she could become the same radicalized figure she did become. You have a combination of language and moral authority that, if you can muster it, is very powerful. And that leads me to my final point, which is just listen to good speakers. Just listen to them. Good mechanics in your delivery can allow you to accomplish really amazing things. Listen to the speakers who do this. Pay attention to the mechanics they employ and how the mechanics reflect the meaning. You take Martin Luther King. There is a man who clearly knew that racism in America could not stand. It's morally untenable. And every word he spoke was imbued with this incredible moral authority. Because here was a man who was prepared to die, who in fact, I think, knew that he would die in the defense of this idea. He listened to him speak, and he had this, his voice had this quality that made you listen. When you listened, he had this eloquence, this moral force that was unstoppable. Now, of course, none of you are going to be that good. None of us are going to be that good. But you need to try. The worst thing that you can do for your case is just let the job become a job. What I love most about being a trial attorney is it gives you an opportunity to be great. And not many occupations allow that anymore. So that's that. I will open the floor to any questions you all might have. But thank you for listening.